Hi, welcome to part two of our presentations on the family for the introduction to sociology. Procreative families are families that have kids. The primary function of the procreative family, that is, families built around the pursuit of parenthood, is to reproduce society biologically through procreation, socially through socialization, or in both ways. So that's kind of a mouthful. Biologically means that bodies have kids. Socially means that the ideas and principles are imprinted on those kids. And a procreative family tries to do both, ideally. You're having flesh and blood children, but you're also trying to shape the personhood of those children in the proper principles of living and in who you are, and in the case of Christians, who you are as children growing up as followers of Jesus Christ. Now, given the fact that procreative families have these functions, both of having babies as well as training up children socially, the experience of one's family shifts over time. From the perspective of children, the family is a family of orientation. It's how you get your bearings or how you find your place in life. The family functions to locate children socially and plays a major role in their socialization. Now, when it says from the perspective of children, of course, I've never met a child who says, the function of family is to play a major role in my socialization and be my source of orientation. But that is, in fact, how it works in their life. It gives them a sense of who they are, where they belong, what matters in life. From the point of view of the parents, the family is a family of procreation. The family functions to produce and to socialize children. Again, a lot of parents don't actually put it that way. We are going to have more physical bodies and we are going to socialize them. That's kind of a sociologist's way of putting things. Sometimes parents say, well, we would love children and we love to bring them up and love them and be loved by them. And so again, sometimes the supposedly scientific way of looking at things leaves out a great deal that is very important. In some cultures, marriage imposes upon women the obligation to bear children. In northern Ghana, for example, payment of bride wealth signifies a woman's requirement to bear children, and women using birth control face substantial threats of physical abuse and reprisals. Children are a great blessing, but in some cultures or in some situations, women are regarded to be disgraced if they can't have children. You read that even in some of the stories of the Bible where women just felt terrible and even felt great shame that they were unable to have children. In many cases, God did eventually give them children. But that struggle with infertility is not just a personal, emotional struggle for women in some cultures. It is one that really affects their status, where the family can dump them if they can't have kids. And the price paid for a bride is taken back if she can't produce children. In other cases, procreative families utilize marital privileges, rights, and laws, if they have legal access, to establish legal parenthood of a child, gain control over sexual services, labor, and/or property, establish a joint fund of property for the benefit of children, and/or establish relations between partners' larger familial networks. So again, they're speaking of this in terms of the actual societal aspect of a family that has kids and some of the legal advantages or sometimes even disadvantages that go along with that. You see again the phrasing, to gain control over sexual services. Well, that's not the nicest way of putting the fact that when two people commit to each other, then they commit each other's bodies to each other for life. It's not just to gain control over them, but also to offer oneself to the other. But again, you got to understand the perspective. This is coming from a pretty anti-family writer and someone who sees almost everything in terms of politics and finances. Many people in different societies lack access to marital and family privileges in their social context. In societies with a sexual division of labor, marriage may increase economic opportunities and decrease tax burdens, which can aid the establishment of financially stable families. This is so. In some societies, being married gives tax advantages. The fact is that in some societies, it gives tax disadvantages as well, so it depends what culture you happen to be in. In modern societies, marriage entails particular rights and privileges for those allowed to marry that encourage the formation of new families even when there's no intention of having children. So, for example, people who are past childbearing age and wish to be married have certain reasons to be married for companionship, and society values marriages even that can't produce children. Or you have two people who brought up their children and have been widowed and now they get married. Sometimes you have people who have been divorced and then remarry later in life when neither of them is of childbearing age, or the woman's not of childbearing age anymore. But there are a variety of reasons to marry even when procreation is no longer a part of the picture. How about non-procreative families, families that don't or can't have children? The primary functions of non-procreative families, families that are built around pursuits and desires that don't involve parenthood, is to facilitate social, economic, emotional, and interpersonal support networks. So there are emotional aspects and money aspects to all of this that marriage helps to advance and to combine resources in the pursuit of financial gain or stability, and formalize long-term commitments to one another and to larger familial and social networks, to claim some of the rights, benefits, and privileges granted to procreative families in many countries, and or to adhere to religious, spiritual beliefs about emotional, sexual commitment, trajectory, and purpose. Well, that's quite a mouthful. That was a long, long sentence with a lot of big words, but it basically just means people who marry and don't plan to have children may still have a variety of reasons for getting married. In almost all societies, marriage between brothers and sisters is forbidden, with ancient Egyptian, Hawaiian, and Inca royalty being the rare exceptions. In many societies, marriage between some first cousins is preferred, while at the other extreme, the medieval Catholic Church prohibited marriage even between distant cousins. So you have some societies that allow marriage of very close relatives, and most societies that prohibit marriage between very close relatives. The consequence of the incest taboo is exogamy. And exogamy is the requirement to marry someone from another group. The incest taboo may serve to promote social solidarity. Well, that's a real neutral, sociological way of saying it. Incest, of course, is a very great danger to children when fathers have sexual relations with their own children, or when uncles or cousins, older cousins, may sexually abuse a child. That has tremendous, devastating impact in most circumstances. So exogamy exists for a reason, so that people will not even look upon close relatives as potential spouses or sexual partners. In the Bible, exogamy is taught in the book of Leviticus and as the ongoing standard. Now, in the earliest parts of the Bible, of course, when there was only one man and one woman and their children, then the very first humans would have had marriage between very, very close relatives. But beyond those times, or beyond the times when God established a new people group with Abraham and very close relatives, after that, God gave laws through Moses that continued to be His will and guidance for people ever after. No one is to approach any close relative to have sexual relations. Do not have sexual relations with, and then there's a long list, with your mother, your sister, your grandchild, your aunt, your daughter-in-law, your brother's wife, your neighbor's wife. Do not lie with a man as one lies with a woman, so no homosexuality. Do not defile yourselves. There's exogamy and then there's endogamy. Endogamy means you must marry someone from the same group. Exogamy means you must marry someone from a different group. And the biblical truth is that you need some endogamy and some exogamy. You must marry someone from the same spiritual group. That's spiritual endogamy. You should marry someone with the same faith and the same God, but someone from a different family group which is exogamy. So don't marry anybody who's too closely related, but do marry someone who shares faith in the same God and walks with the Lord Jesus Christ. Courtship is the traditional dating period before engagement and marriage. It's an alternative to arranged marriages, and in arranged marriages, the couple or group doesn't even meet sometimes before the wedding. During a courtship, a couple or group gets to know each other and decides if there will be an engagement. Courting includes activities such as dating, where couples go together for some activity, a meal, a movie, or whatever. Courting can also take place without personal contact with modern technology. You've got virtual dating, chatting online, texting, messaging, talking on the phone, writing letters, sending gifts. These are all modern forms of courting, and obviously they require electronic means of communication which didn't exist in previous eras of courtship. While the date is fairly casual in most European-influenced cultures, in some traditional societies, courtship is a highly structured activity with very specific formal rules. In some societies, the parents or community propose potential partners, and then they allow limited dating to determine whether the parties are suited. So this is kind of an approach which blends two different elements. It's not a completely arranged marriage where the parents or clan say, here's who you're going to marry and that's that, but neither is it a completely whatever two people happen to feel for each other approach. The parents or community suggest, hey, here, this looks like it'd be a good partner for you, and then they allow the individuals involved to get together on a limited basis to find out whether they really do like each other and do want to get married. So it combines personal desire with family input. In more closed societies, courtship is virtually eliminated altogether by the practice of arranged marriages, where partners are chosen for young people, typically by their parents or, in the absence of parents, other local authorities. Why would people have arranged marriages? Well, forbidding experimental and serial courtship and sanctioning only arranged matches is partly a means of guarding the chastity of young people, of keeping them from becoming sexual partners with a variety of people, and it's partly a matter of furthering family interests, in which such cultures and some cultures consider those family interests more important than just what romantic vibes individuals happen to feel for each other. So they arrange marriages. Now, the ironic truth of the matter is that in many cultures where there are arranged marriages, they do end up being more stable and even being more affectionate than those that are conducted in singles bars and doing whatever you want. You would think that the romance-only approach would be the only place where love flourishes, but in fact, love can flourish even in arranged marriages, and sometimes more so than in cultures where people are just sleeping around one with another until they happen to get married to one of them. In earlier centuries, young adults were expected to court with the intention of finding marriage partners rather than for social reasons. You just didn't date as a recreational activity. You were looking for somebody to get married to. But by the 1920s, dating for fun was becoming an expectation. And by the 1930s, it was assumed that any popular young person would have lots of dates. And that was kind of a new thing, dating without any purpose or thought of marriage in mind, but just dating for the sheer fun of it. This form of dating, though, was usually more chaste, that is, they didn't hop in bed together, than is seen today, since premarital sex was not considered the norm, even though it was fairly widespread. If you just go back to some of the research I did in Britain, in 1960, 4% of children were born out of wedlock, and that number approaches close to half. So even though some sexual involvement was occurring in the era of dating, the fact is, before the era of birth control, there were still a lot less children being born out of wedlock, and those who did get pregnant got married. As a result of social changes spurred on by the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s, the taboo of sex during dating began to wane, and so sex became one of the activities associated with casual dating. Mark Rigneris, a Christian sociologist, has written a book called Cheap Sex, and Rigneris is one of the leading researchers in sociology on the whole area of changes in sexual morality, marriage, monogamy. And what are the findings in his book, Cheap Sex? Well, he says that birth control and abortion separated sex from having children. So procreation became less and less significant in male-female relations. And hooking up, pornography, and online dating separated sex from marriage. People would just have friends with benefits. They'd hook up, they'd have sex for a night, and then that would be it. Or people go online, look at pornography to their heart's content, and they could see all the women they wanted, or all the naked men they wanted, or sexual intercourse, all they wished, and it had absolutely nothing to do with their own marriage. And Rigneris finds that when men get sex without commitment or children, fewer men pursue marriage. Fewer men pursue education. Fewer men pursue steady employment. Because many men are motivated by being a leader and a provider and having a family, or motivated at least by a desire for sex. And if they can have that, cheap or free, then they'll take it. And they won't grow up and become responsible men. As porn increased, so did masturbation. In 1992, 29% of men and 9% of women masturbated at least once a week. In 2014, 49% of men and 32% of women masturbated in the previous 6 days. So pornography and the sense of sexuality totally disconnected from relationship has had a major impact, not just among singles or among teens, but among all people of adult age. What's best for children? Well, according to our WikiBooks textbook, systematic research continues to support a view that courtship is a social process that socializes all sexes into accepting forms of relationship that maximize the chances of successfully raising children. I'll just say that again. A particular approach to finding a mate that socializes people into an arrangement that maximizes the chances of successfully raising children. That's what a man and a woman getting together with the right person and being faithful to each other, that's one of the primary things, is this is the best context for raising children. And even the most secularized anti-Christian sociologist kind of has to admit that. But this may negatively impact women, particularly those seeking independence and equality at work. Well, yeah, men and women both have to give up something if they want to be great parents. And so if you consider a negative impact to have children and to bring them up, if your main interest was career, then sure, you can't have it all to the same degree. Men and women both will have to make sacrifices if children are in the picture. Marriage, what is it? Well, according to the textbook, it's a governmentally, socially, or religiously recognized interpersonal relationship, usually intimate and sexual, that's often created as a form of contract, or we Christians might say rather than contract, covenant. The most frequent form of marriage is between a woman and a man, where the feminine term wife and the masculine husband are generally used to describe the parties to the contract. Aren't you glad that you had a sociologist to tell you that? A male spouse is a husband. A female spouse is a wife. But we live in a brave new world where sometimes it's now considered discriminatory to speak of a husband and a wife, because a spouse isn't necessarily a male spouse, might be the spouse of another male, and a female spouse might be the spouse of another female, or it may be some other arrangement altogether, or the man may have turned into a woman, or the woman into a man. So it is an unusual age in which we live, in which we need to be told that a female spouse is a woman and a male spouse is a man traditionally, and even that, of course, is not the definition they would prefer anymore. Other forms of marriage also exist. For example, polygamy, in which a person takes more than one spouse, is present in many societies. That's true. At least in the past, it was true, and in some societies still today. Currently, the legal concept of marriage is expanding to include same-sex marriage in some areas. Well, that's true too. that now you can legally be called a husband and wife even if two men get together or two women get together. But calling it that doesn't make it that. We reinvented the meaning of the word marriage, totally different from what it has meant in the history of the world and throughout every culture. And we haven't seen the full impact of that experiment just yet. The reasons people marry may vary widely, but usually include, well, to publicly and formally declare their love. Hey, even some love made it into the textbook. The formation of a single household unit, legitimizing sexual relations and procreation, social and economic stability, and the education and nurturing of children. And all of these are indeed important elements of marriage. The act of marriage creates obligations between the individuals involved and in some societies between the parties' extended families. Marriages are perpetual agreements with legal consequences terminated only by the death of one party or by a formal dissolution process such as divorce or annulment. People without a high school diploma are unlikely to marry someone with more educational attainment. Now we're getting into some interesting aspects of sociology, you know, not just trying to import a new ideology into marriage, but just some observations about who gets married to whom. And if you're without a high school diploma, you probably won't marry someone with a college degree. You might, but it's not very likely. People with a college degree are likely to marry people with a similar level of educational attainment. This is one of the things in our society, in Western societies, that tends to separate people in marriage from one class or another. It's not a law, it just kind of happens that way socially. In some societies, such as Hindu societies, there is a caste system where you are not allowed to marry someone from a different caste or a different social level. We don't have a formal caste system in Western societies, but sometimes it almost functions like one. And one of the big dividers is simply the level of education that people receive. Part of the reason for this is because people tend to form groups based on levels of education. First, there are the groups formed in the process of becoming educated. Many people meet their spouses in school. You go to college and you meet somebody there. Or you don't go to college and you start working somebody. You start working and you meet somebody there in that kind of setting. So you happen to meet people in certain settings, and a lot of people college age get to know people. Also, jobs after one completes education tend to be grouped by levels of education. So you get hired by a company that only hires people with college degrees. You work in a company of 500 people, who are you most likely to meet and eventually marry? Well, in many cases, it's one of your coworkers who just happens to have the same kind of education and background as you do. So marriage and education are very closely related in terms of who you're most likely to marry. As a result, people spend more time at work or in school with individuals of a similar level of educational attainment. Most people tend to marry or partner with individuals with whom they spend a lot of time. Yeah, that's no surprise. So there's significant educational similarity between spouses. One well-known attribute of marriage is that it tends to have health benefits. So moving from marriage and education, let's look at marriage and health. And marriage is good for you. Happily married people tend to be healthier than unmarried people. However, unhappily married couples may not receive the same health benefits and may actually be less healthy than their single peers. So to have an absolutely miserable marriage is not the way to say, oh, I heard marriage is good for you, so I'm going to get married, for the same reasons I eat health food. Well, a rotten marriage will also rot away at you. But overall, healthy, stable marriages do contribute to the health of husband and wife. Kids raised in families with only one parent or with step-parents are more likely to have behavioral problems than are kids raised with families that remain connected throughout the child's life course. Children whose fathers are more involved in their lives are less likely to have behavior problems. This is very weighty coming from somebody who is a bit anti-family and who tries to pretend that lots of different arrangements are equally good. The fact is that sociological research finds that stable, two-parent families with very involved fathers give children their best opportunity in life. That doesn't mean that other children have no opportunity, but it does mean that you're placing children at a great disadvantage when they're not in a healthy marriage relationship as they're being brought up. Here's some child-rearing trends. Less parental influence on a child's mate selection due to independent life stage. So basically what that means is often kids go off to college or they leave the home and move somewhere and they work at a distance from their parents. So the mom and dad have less influence on who that child is going to choose. And in some societies, of course, the mom and dad don't pick the spouse, but sometimes mom and dad's input or the input of some brothers and sisters may influence a little bit who you happen to choose as a marriage partner. And there's less parental influence now. There's more freedom for children in private, this private space of home, and there's less freedom in public spaces. What's that mean? Well, there's more freedom in your private space because every kid with a smartphone or a computer can be in communication with people all over the place, and they can do all sorts of things there, right in their own home. On the other hand, public places in many cities are less safe, and parents don't want their kids playing out on the street at night, sometimes not even during the daytime, so kids have more freedom to do a bunch of stuff in their room, but a lot less freedom to just run around and do stuff wherever they want in their neighborhood. Another child-rearing trend is parenting by lying. Not sure I like that one, but parents will sometimes not be candid with their children or will try more to manipulate their children by telling them certain things than by simply speaking the truth to them. Another child-rearing trend is less spanking, less corporal punishment. That's what the sociologists say, and I should say that's also what the sociologists want. Many sociologists feel that any form of corporal punishment, any spanking at all, is wrong. And they have some reason to say that simply because they've seen the terrible consequences of child abuse and of severe beatings. And so their reaction is to say that all spanking must be bad. So they have a legitimate concern, but perhaps they carry that concern a little farther than they ought to. Well, we've talked about procreative families, about marriages and having children. What about kids? Kids are expensive to raise. And the more kids a family has, on average, the lower the social class, though this is a complicated relationship as the causal direction goes both ways. So, again, the author of the textbook says, hey, kids cost a lot of money, and usually people in lower social classes have more kids. Notice that last phrase, though. Sometimes the causal direction goes both ways. Some people say, we couldn't have kids because they're so expensive. The truth of the matter is that as societies become wealthier, they have fewer children. And it's not because they have fewer children that they become wealthier. It's as they have become wealthier, it becomes less the in thing to have sizable families. And there's quite a bit of research that would show that societies could have children, they could raise them, they could feed them, and it was not having less children that made them richer. It was getting richer that made them more focused on other things besides bringing up children. At any rate, however you think about that, you can say, hey, kids are expensive. Or you can look at things from the Bible's point of view without denying the cost of bringing up children. Sons are a heritage from the Lord. Children a reward from Him. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. Children are a tremendous blessing. They are a reward from God. And we had better see them as a blessing before we regard them as a problem or as an expense. And we should give thanks every day if God has blessed us with children.